Hi, my name is Ajit. And Marsha was wanting to talk to me just to find out how to pronounce my name correctly. And I told her I have about 90-odd versions to my name, so one more wouldn't hurt. And before I say anything, Dick Martin asked me to make a very special announcement. He wanted me to let you know that I'm not Iraqi. But I have a feeling that even if I were, you'd accept me anyway. I hope so. I just want to let Marsha know that before I come from Bombay, India, through Detroit and Chicago to California. So quite a route. And when I got to California, I picked up my 91st version to my name. I did not realize that in California, they do not pronounce the J. My name is spelled A-J-I-T. And I was at the AFG, which is the Al-Anon Family Groups Convention in Anaheim. And I was asked to be a 15-minute speaker at one of the meetings there. They're wiser. They did not want me to speak for an hour. They wanted me to speak for 15 minutes. And I was sitting in the wrong room. And as I walked out, there was a lady looking rather, how should I say, confused. And she was rather harried, I should say. Running around, she looked at me. She said, "Are you a heat?" And I thought she was asking me if I was in heat. And I figured it was my bedroom eyes or something like that. But much to my chagrin, that wasn't it. She was mispronouncing my name. Before I start, I do want to thank you all, especially the committee and Bill and Marsha, for making me feel very, very comfortable. I got picked up by Pat at the airport. She had a blazing pink psychedelic-looking card, Greeley Stampede, and I know I'm sure people were wondering what the hell it was all about, but I was delighted to see her. She picked me up and brought me here, and I thank you very much. It's been very, very comfortable, very nice. And I usually am insensitive to stuff like that, so I want to get it out of the way and thank the committee and thank the people involved. It's been very special. I'm learning to be a grateful member of Al-Anon. And what I do is I normally tell you my story and how it was, what happened, and how it is today. And I want to go back. As I took my fourth step, you know, it says in there in our One Day at a Time book, there must be a child inside calling to another child. Why do we seek out alcoholics in our life, or, you know, we marry people who are alcoholic or have dysfunctions, if you will? There must be something wrong with us. So I wanted to track back into my childhood and see what happened, not to put blame on, but perhaps find a reason for what was happening in my life at the moment. And I looked back and I realized why I was a people pleaser, why I was an enabler, why I had certain characteristics, if you will, defects of character, as we put it. What prompted that? Because my wife drank alcoholically for about 3.5 years. And I figured it wasn't in those 3.5 years that I got to be crazy. There must have been something that had happened early on in my childhood or in my life that caused me to behave the way I did. And I went back and I looked at my life. And I realized that I was born in a family of four, after two daughters to my father. My grandmother, being that we are from a chauvinistic society, at least when, how should I say, we announce ourselves as chauvinistic. My grandmother prayed for a male child to be born to her son. And she went on a pilgrimage to pray for me. And on the 11th of May, 1952, which makes me almost 39, my God's gift to my family arrived into our home. I was a fair-haired, blue-eyed, golden child. California has tanned me. My eyes have turned brown. Only teasing. And I was treated rather special for the package that I was rather than for what was within me. I wasn't told what was inside of me. It was the external, the way I looked, the way I walked, the way I carried myself, the way I spoke. It was the constant emphasis on the package. And I soon realized how I could use that to manipulate my way around the house and around my parents. My mother was smart. She did not discipline me. But my uncles and we lived in a large joint family. They treated me rather, how should I say, specially. And I knew nothing about this disease called alcoholism, despite the fact that I lost an uncle to this disease. He had a few other things that were wrong about him, and I think that's what prevented us from naming whatever he had or calling it a disease. And some of the things he did that perhaps caused problems or precluded us from calling him a sick person was the fact that he smoked a lot and he gambled. And God forgive him, he lived in the wrong part of town. And God forgive him even more, he hung around with the wrong element of women. Is there any wrong element of women in here? My apologies. But he also drank. So he said, hey, he gambles, smokes, womanizes, and drinks. He's morally decrepit, and he's a loser. You know, nothing about the fact that he had a disease, and that these were merely symptoms of his illness. And as a matter of fact, he died with cataracts in both his eyes, almost blinded, cirrhosis of the liver, completely decrepit, if you will, physically. His wife actually threw him out of a moving car. I think she practiced the art of detachment to the extreme. They just bounced him out. I mean, I know now that is not detachment, that's distancing. And he was picked up by his brothers and taken to a regular hospital where he passed away. But I knew nothing about this crazy illness, and I was in my sixth, we call them standards there, sixth or seventh standard, we had a vice principal. We called them headmasters. And I was informed that this headmaster had started the first AA chapter in Bombay, India. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, what the hell is AA? He said, oh, they get drunks off the street and get them sober. Little did I realize that many years later, I would be picking one such drunk up and finding her and watching her find her way into sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm eternally grateful to that program for what it's given to us. But anyway, I finished up with school, and I decided that I would go seek my guru. I climbed a mountain in my best loincloth. I'm only kidding. We wear trousers and jackets. And I walked up to this guru, and I said, oh, great one, I seek serenity. And he said, go to Detroit, Michigan, and join Al-Anon. What he did not warn me about was that I had to marry an alcoholic in the process. And if you're not married to one, no, I'm only kidding. If you're in love with one, hang around 6 months at least before you make up your mind. But anyway, I finished up with school, and I was going to seek my fortune in the United States of America. I had my sisters here ahead of me. You know, we foreigners are like that. One of us gets here, and the other part, the family, just follows through. And I was told before I left, they said, do not get involved with American women. And I said, why? Said, because they drink and they smoke. Oh God, that's so masculine. Because the Indian women that drink and smoke do it in the closet. They don't show you that they're doing it. And I'm sure there are women alcoholics in India, but American women sort of manifest that rather openly. And I did not particularly care about the cigarette part. I mean, I could handle it. It's got a strange taste in your mouth if you kiss a woman who's been smoking. But I liked the alcohol. Candy's dandy, liquor's quicker. It made my progress into the evening extremely efficient. I liked it. As a matter of fact, my favorite hangout in Detroit was Greektown, where you could get a bottle of Roditas wine with a full course meal, and the entire date cost about $20-$25, dessert included, followed by Greek coffee, which is mud in the form of coffee. And I loved it because if the date was afraid to go to downtown Detroit, I'd take her down there and she'd just be dazzled by this place called Greektown. And the bottle of wine did its trick. I loved it. And I did not mind the fact that these women drank. But they did not drink the way my wife did. And I've come to recognize why my dates were so, or my relationships were so short-lived. I think the longest relationship I had with a normal woman, I suppose, was about 2 months. And I think I figured out why. I think we pre-Al-Anons, or potential Al-Anons, carry this little laser beam in our heads. We sink on. Alcoholic? No, move on. Don't waste your time. Alcoholic? No, don't waste your time. Move on. And I remember quite clearly, I was dating this one girl, and I was invited to a party at my boss's house. In a couple of weeks, and I stopped in at the student hangout that I used to go to at Wayne State University. I used to be a part-time lecturer there, so I used to take my students out. And I walked into this bar, and this woman came and waited at our table. She was working her way through nursing school, and this laser beam just went off. Married your alcoholic. This is your alcoholic. This is your alcoholic. You know, marry her, meet her, do something. So I looked at this girl, and I said, will you go out with me to this party? And I guess her laser beam went off, met my enabler, met my enabler, met my enabler. And she said yes. So I dropped the other one and took Sue to this party. And I should have taken note of a few very obvious clues that warned me that something, some impending doom was headed my way. We went to this restaurant before dinner, I mean before the party, and had dinner. And for the very first time in my life, I actually had a conversation with a woman. Because normally my conversations were one track. I pretended to listen, my head moved, but my mind was indulged in machinations as to how I was going to take this woman from the restaurant to my apartment. But with Sue, I was talking to her. I was actually exchanging thoughts. And we were talking about feelings. We were exchanging bits of information that had nothing to do with that big S, you know, in terms of my bedroom. And it was funny. I should have left her at the restaurant, gotten my car, and driven away. But no, I took her to the party. Excuse me, just the very thought of it is driving my throat dry. Anyway, went to the party, and clue number two came headed my way in the form of a guy by the name of George. And George walked up to me and he said, "You and Sue look so comfortable together. How long have you been dating? 5, 10 years? And I said, "George, I just met this woman 2 weeks ago." And he said, "Oh no, that's not possible. You look so well together. You look so comfortable. I should have left Sue at the party and driven away." No, I didn't. Well, we dated about 3 or 4 months, which was past my record of 2 months. And one evening, there was a knock on the door at 10 o'clock. I remember this very, very distinctly, as if it happened about this evening or so. And I opened the door, and Sue's standing there with a big lump on her head. And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "My mother, in an alcoholic rage, struck me." Well, the father in me, the enabler in me, the knight in shining armor in me, all these various personalities that Sybil would have envied came rushing forth. And I said, "You are not going back to that woman." Now, a Hindu from Bombay, India, does not ask a Polish Catholic girl from Warren, Michigan to move in with her. She did. And what was scary was her mother helped her move in. I knew I was in trouble from that time on. And we lived in sin for a year and we decided to get married. But I started to notice a few things. I noticed I'd come home in the afternoon. Sue had varying shifts. She was working for some doctors. And I'd watch her sipping on a glass of wine while watching a TV show or doing some ironing or whatever she was doing. Now, I took a class in sociology in school. And my professor said that alcohol and cigarettes were social lubricants. In other words, if I wanted to strike up a conversation with you in a restaurant or a bar, offer you a cigarette or offer to buy you a drink or do something of the sort. And the fact was that you never drank alone. I always was confused. I could not figure out who Sue was socially lubricating with in the apartment all by herself. Unless it was Luke on General Hospital or something like that. Or I'd come home in the afternoon sometime and I'd walk into this bathroom that we had downstairs. And this bathroom plays an important role in the scheme of things. And there was this little cabinet you have under the sink where you have toilet paper and stuff like that. And open it up and I'd see 6 or 7 empty cans of beer in there. And I'd ask Sue, I said, "What the hell are 6 or 7 empty cans of beer doing in this cabinet sink? I mean, in the cabinet, and they're not even in the trash can." And Sue said, "Oh, Aunt Bunny came over and had a few beers." And it never occurred to me why Aunt Bunny would take a six-pack into the John and drink it and leave the empty cans under the sink. I thought, you know, maybe she was eliminating the middlemen and saying, "I'm going to flush them down anyway." I mean, alcoholics have a reason to say that they're crazy. They do not have a problem when they drink. They get drunk and they pass out. It's the pre-Al-Anons, if you will. I do not like to say I was the Al-Anon because I was an Al-Anon at the time. I did not know any better. But I'd come home and start to sniff around and go through garbage cans. I mean, why? When you see this woman is drunk on the floor and you want to do these strange things. But anyway, I made my first mistake. I told Sue, I said, "Sue, you need to drink to your limit." And you know how I knew about limits? When I was a youngster, my uncle used to drink and he'd always say, "Drink to your limit." And I said, "What the hell is your limit? How do you know?" And he said, "You drink to the state of euphoria. When you feel just right, you stop." In other words, once you have the strange desire to wear the lampshade, you've gone too far. And I walked up to Sue. I said, you know, I've noticed that two glasses of wine are just right for you because you're a terrific person. When you get to the third, you make an ass out of me. You trip over things. See how we take it upon ourselves? What she does is reflecting upon me. I'm embarrassed because you trip over this and you have mozzarella in your face when you eat pizza and it looks bad for me. So stop. Now, I found out one thing. You do not tell an alcoholic what to drink, how much to drink, when to drink, or anything like that, because they make it their life goal to prove you otherwise. But Sue did. Or I tell Sue, you know, you shouldn't drink scotch. Drink wine, because that's right for you. Well, needless to say that Sue did not listen to me, and her drinking got progressively worse because I started, and I'm not saying I caused her to drink. The alcoholism was genetic. Her mother had it. Her father has it, apparently. And I'm sure there are other people. I think it's a Polish and Irish disease from what I found out. So it's there. I'm just kidding. There's some element of truth to it, though, I suppose, from what I've heard people say to me. But anyway, Sue's drinking got worse, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. I mean, I tried to find a reason for it, but I did not know that she had this disease called alcoholism. I did not even know she had a drinking problem for the longest time, because she kept saying she had headaches, and that's why she slept, or she wasn't feeling well, so she was going to sleep. She did not indulge in any of the fancy drugs that some of the other speakers had mentioned, thank God, because I'd have killed myself, I'm sure. But she drank copiously, and I did not know about this till one day we were driving over to visit with some of my family in the Michigan area, in the Detroit area. And we got into a rip-roaring royal spat. I mean, we just got into a nasty fight. And I looked at Sue and I said, we are not going to my relative's house in the state that you're in. I'm going to take you back and leave you at our house, and I'm going to go by myself. So I dropped her off, and as I'm walking past this fateful bathroom, I see her trying to jam the door shut on this cabinet. And inside was a 55-gallon drum of Gallo wine. It was only a half a gallon jug, but it assumed this enormous proportion. And out of the blue came this little sound into the back of my head, right by medulla oblongata here. It says, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic. Now see, to me, alcoholics are those 3% they talk about in understanding ourselves, the bums, the skid row types. My wife did not even have a stubble. She's not Italian, so, you know. only teasing. I'm just being nasty, you know. I love it. Pardon me if you're Italian. I love Italians. Some of them are best friends of mine. Anyway, so I denied the fact that this woman has alcoholic, but the symptoms are so obvious in terms of what happened, because it came roaring out, and I confronted Sue. I said, you are an alcoholic, and you need to get help. And she said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. Our problem is our marriage, because we have a cultural situation. I'm Polish, and you're not. So I figured, she said, we are going to find a marriage counselor to help us out. And needless to say, I volunteered to do the task. I was going to find us a marriage counselor, except in my manipulative way, I was going to find a marriage counselor who was also an alcoholic recovery program counselor. So I called this guy up and I said, this is how it is. I'm going to walk in with this woman under the, with the presumption that we have a marital problem, but you take one look at her and tell her that she's an alcoholic. And then do whatever you need to do. So it's all planned. So I walk into this guy's office, and I think they teach them this one question in Psych 101. The moron looked at us and said, so, what's the problem? Now see, that was a magic word for me, because when my wife drank and I was going nuts, knowing nothing about alcoholism, if you stopped me on the street and said, what's the time, I'd say my wife drinks too much. If I was on a plane, you'd say, you're flying from Detroit, I'd say my wife drinks too much. Say, how is it? I'd say, well, my wife drinks too much. So when this guy said, so what's the problem? I said, my wife drinks too much. He said, oh, terrific, no problem, sit down. And he pulls out this yellow notepad and he starts telling us about this wonderful treatment center he has at this hospital. My wife's crying and I'm looking at this idiot saying, why did you ask me what the problem is? You should have told her that you could see it on her face. Needless to say, he was a lousy salesman to boot. He let us go on an outpatient basis. And Sue said that he wasn't the one that would help us, that she would find someone who would. And she did. He went to see this guy, and guess what he said? "So, what's the problem?" And I said, "Oh, no, I've heard this before," I said. And I was supposed to not say anything, but, you know, the reflexive mechanism just kicked in, and I said, "My wife drinks too much." So he kind of looked at me rather oddly, and he said, "So, what's the problem?" And I said, "Something's not registering here. Maybe my accent is getting in the way." So I said, "My wife drinks too much." And he said, "So, what's the problem with that?" And suddenly I noticed that if you shut the light off in that room, he could have served as a red traffic signal. His nose was so red. And I looked at my wife and I said, "He's got a drinking problem." My wife said, "No, he understands." We saw him about 3 times after that and he disappeared. And I looked at my wife and I said, "I was right." See, that was my quest in life. That was my goal. I had to be right. I got the last word in. Even if the plate was flying at me, I had to say that. And we went on our merry way, still throwing each other out of the house. My wife, to add to my problems, was verbally and physically abusive. I did not know she could pitch a dish faster than Tommy John can pitch a ball. And I'd be like a fool because, see, I didn't want the neighbors to find out we had a problem. No. You know, that's what always boggles me. How come alcoholics become anonymous after they get sober? Everyone in the... I mean, all kidding aside, I know it's a spiritual side of it, but all of a sudden, don't tell anyone I'm an alcoholic. Boy, they know you drank like a, you know, like it was going out of style. So I'd run around shutting all the windows and doors down. I know the women in Al-Anon identify with that. And I'd go around shutting these doors and windows and stand and dodge her dishes while she was throwing them at me. And I couldn't figure out how to get her sober. And I talked to my friends. I had this friend who was a major in philosophy. And we'd sit at a bar smoking the cheapest of cigars, drinking the cheapest of wine, talking about the whys and wherefores of alcoholism. What caused my wife to be the way she was? And then one day, I was reading the Detroit Free Press. I'm one of those sensitive 80s and 90s kinds of guys. I was reading Ann Landers and Dear Abby. And Ann Landers had this big thing in the paper that said, if you're married to child off, husband off, whatever off, an alcoholic, Al-Anon is for you. I said, finally, someone's going to help me find sobriety for her. See, I'd given up on her. I decided my only way out of this problem was murder. I was going to kill her. And I did not want to go to jail, so I read this story in a magazine called Argosy, and Alfred Hitchcock had written this. He said, the perfect murder weapon is one that cannot be discovered at all. Not in the bottom of an ocean, not in a mud pile, not on the top of a mountain, it just disappears. And if you live in Michigan in wintertime, you can see there's icicles that drip down. Now this is sane thinking. I'm the sane one whose life is manageable. And I'm sitting there and saying, I'm going to use this icicle and I'm going to kill her. And I said, what are you going to do with her body? I said, I'm going to go down to the basement, I'm going to dig it up, and I'm going to bury her. And I know nothing about masonry, but I was going to dig up my concrete basement and bury her. Now you'd think that the fear of God or the morality of the issue would be the problem, but no. I was afraid of my mother-in-law who lived about a mile and a half away. Who'd come down and discover her daughter missing, because she had helped her move in with me, remember? And she'd reported to the police, and I'd be, you know, friends with a guy named Bubba someplace. And I just did not want that. So I decided that maybe I'd try this place called Al-Anon out. I'm surprised not many alcoholics come to Al-Anon to seek sobriety, because I thought they would tell me there how my wife could get sober. So I walked into this room in a place called Warren, Michigan. If you're from Warren, Michigan, be grateful that you're here today. And if you're not from Warren, Michigan, be thankful that you're not from Warren, Michigan. I'm only kidding. It's a nice General Motors town, Chrysler, anything like that. And I walked into this dark, dingy room where there were about 6 people sitting, and the average age looked deceased. I saw 6 dead people. The skeletons, and there were cobwebs, and... chattering, and I looked at the woman. That was my attitude. That's how I went in. Really pompous. You know, they say in the understanding ourselves, some of us are arrogant and whatever else, and I was one of those whatever else's. And I looked at this woman and I said, how does this work? And she handed me a pamphlet that said the 12 steps. Now, we got an escape clause for Al-Anon, the 12 steps. We say, these 12 steps are adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous. We change one word. Where it says alcoholics, we change it to others. So I read the first step. I said, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I said, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I drink to my state of euphoria. I do not run around in lampshades. And that my life is not unmanageable, despite the fact I'd plotted this woman's murder. So this applies to the alcoholic. Move on. Said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Said, I'm sane. She's the insane one. Very clever thinking. Move on to step three. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I said, God helps those who help themselves. Why turn my will over to him when he's given it to me in the first place? So I said, does not apply to me. Took a fearless and personal moral inventory of myself. Found myself to be perfect. I was living with this woman, wasn't I? Moved on to step five. Nothing to give away. If nothing's wrong, why tell someone? See, I was into image management. Even if something was wrong, you were not going to find out, because you had to see me in my perfect state. Six and seven, I had nothing to be removed from me. If you're perfect, why get anything removed? Came to eight and nine to make amends. My motto was, do unto others before they do unto you. And if I told you something, if I did something wrong to you, you deserved it. And if otherwise, it was for your own good. So you'd learn a lesson. So eight and nine did not come into play. 10, continued to take a personal inventory, and I loved it because I was perfect. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. I had a great deal with God going. I'd make deals with him. He knew, you know, we were traders, right in the used car lot. I'd tell him what I needed and what I was going to do in return, and he'd do it for me or punish me. I was spiritually awakened in about 30 seconds. That was my record. And I said, wonderful. I looked at the woman and I said, now what? She said those three words that I hated for the longest time. She said, keep coming back. I mean, I felt like Moon Zappa. I wanted to take a spoon and gag myself. I said, for what? And she said, because you need it. You're sick. And I looked at her. I said, tell me one thing. I said, before we do anything else, how long have you been married to your drunk? Or to your husband, I said. And she said, for 30 years. Now, I have a smile on my face because I think that Sharon said, with the Al-Anon smile. I did not know I had that. I gave her this lovely smile. And I said, is he still drinking? And she said, yes. And I'm condemning her. See, I'm critique. I never condemn people. I critiqued them. I said, you pathetic slob. And I'm smiling. And I said, why, pray tell, are you married to this drunk for 30 years? And she said, oh, he supports me. And I'm saying, oh, you prostitute, you know. But I'm smiling at her. And I looked at her and I said, I give my wife 6 lousy months. If she doesn't sober up, I leave. And she gave me a strange smile, a very, very strange smile. And in retrospect, I recognized what the smile said. It said, the sicker they are, the harder they'll fall, and this kid will keep coming back. And she was right. I went back to that meeting every 6 weeks. Great way to work a program. In the meanwhile, I did strange things. I became an excellent student of garbology. I'd come home and I'd dig through the garbage can. Now, this is sane thinking. I'd come home, here's a woman lying on the rug with strange emanations from her mouth that reek of some kind of, I don't know what the body does to food, but it smells terrible when it regurgitates it. And the woman is obviously drunk, and I'm walking over to the garbage can to do what a lot of us, before we come to Al-Anon, do, the aha. You know, aha. And I'd critique her drinking. I'd say, she's been drinking wine with a screw top. My God, what a pathetic drunk. Or I'd, you know, say, wow, today she has a cork. You know, it's a nicer wine. Terrific. Or Kmart champagne. Boy, how low can you get? All this time, the woman is drunk. And I thought I was nuts till I ran into a sponsor of mine. He said, that isn't any, there's nothing bad about that. So what do you mean? He said, he picked up a trick in the army. He used to fix jeeps in the middle of the night, the flashlight in his mouth so he could work with both hands. And he found that to be extremely efficient because he could go through 2 garbage cans in the middle of the night with a flashlight in his mouth while his wife slept. I did a few of the nasty things. And they were very creative endeavors in energy, what you call expenditure. And if you haven't done this, try it. It's fun. Doesn't accomplish anything, but what the heck. See, my wife told me she did not have a drinking problem. So my thinking was, and this is very sane thinking, that if she knew that I knew that she had a drinking problem, she would get sober. So my objective was to catch her in the act. So I'd sit on this couch that faced our TV set, and I was fond of doing the crossword puzzle because I'd like to use words with her to punish her. I'd use words like ennui, you know, stuff you pick up in a crossword puzzle. You never use that word, but I wanted to do it to make her feel small. Oh, I feel somnolent. And so what the hell are you talking about? But anyway, I'd sit and watch the TV reflection. TV isn't on. This is sane. Because I could see what was happening in the kitchen. And Sue would pour out a drink, pour it in a glass, drink it, and hide the bottle. And I was a cheap bastard. I never threw booze away, but I played with her mind. When she went to bed, I'd move the bottle around to another cabinet. Or I'd pull it out and put it back on the counter. And then, this is even more wonderful, I stayed awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's when she went for a fix, to listen for the sounds of the clutter that would happen downstairs. This is really smart thinking. Now, who's the sick one? The one who drinks, gets drunk, and passes out, or the fellow who has no crutch of any kind? You know, I'm not drinking anything, I'm not smoking any grass or anything like that to get a buzz while this is going on. I am sitting awake to listen to this clutter. Or I'd come home and she'd tell me she hadn't been drinking. I'd come home and, you know how you kiss and smell at the same time? And I found myself getting slap happy. You know, I was consuming more alcohol, secondhand fumes, than she was consuming, drinking it. And I'd wonder, what the hell was, why was I getting buzzed when she was drinking? But anyway, I went back to this Al-Anon meeting once every 6 weeks, and they'd make an announcement to say, is anyone working on the first step? And I figured first step meant that I had to regurgitate what was going on the previous week, 6 weeks, in terms of telling them about my wife's drunkalogue. And I'd sit there and tell them the funny things she did, and how the police came, the sounds she heard, and what I did, and how she struck me, and how I struck back, and all that sort of good stuff. And they'd look at me and they'd say, keep coming back. And I'd go back every 6 weeks, thinking that's how the program was meant to work. Nothing changed, but they said something in there that screwed me up completely. They said that alcoholism was a disease. See, to me, Sue was morally decrepit. If only she could use a willpower, she could stop drinking. And they said, you know, this disease is like cancer or diabetes. And that really bowled me over. I hated you guys for doing that to my mind. Because, see, I was a pseudo-intellectual. Jack said he was an intellectual. I was a pseudo-intellectual, or is an intellectual. And I tried to analyze this. I said, now diabetics take something akin to something like insulin. And cancer patients go get chemotherapy. So why can't this woman who has a disease like these two other diseases go get some kind of methadone or anabuse or some kind of drug treatment? I didn't know that this disease was beyond the physiological or clinical definition of disease. To me, this was it. But on the other hand, my mind would say, I don't know how he developed the split personalities, these two things talking to each other. And the other mind would say, but you know, she has a disease, and if she has a disease, you can't leave. That's not right. You married her for better or worse. This is worse. You stick with it. And I'd stay. And the other mind would say, no, you're nuts. She's driving into this ground. You leave. But this disease bit that you guys threw at me just confused the hell out of me. And then came along my new company that I started work for. And my boss came up to me, and he says, Ajit, we had high expectations of you, and you're not performing. And I looked at him and I said, oh, Bill, my wife drinks too much. And he said, why don't you say so? We have this wonderful treatment program at a place called Hazelden, Minnesota, and they'll cover for you, they'll pay for her treatment, and they'll even fly you in. Everything will be done first class. I said, I love it. So they sent in a guy from New York, an old codger, who was a recovering alcoholic, and they talked my wife into going to this treatment program. See, I dragged my wife into an AA meeting once before in that same building in Warren, Michigan. The only reason I knew it was an AA meeting is there was tons of cigarette smoke coming out. And there was an old crusty man standing at the door, and he said, who's the alky? And Lone Ranger was proud of my draw. I said, she is, before he thought I was. And he grabbed her and took her in, and I said, she'll get sober. But as most of you in AA know, and all of us in Al-Anon know, the alcoholic does not seek sobriety just because the Al-Anon or pre-Al-Anon wants him or her to. They have to do it in their own time. I heard someone say, those who haven't found it yet haven't finished writing their story. And my wife wasn't done writing her story yet. So she came out of that meeting and went out drinking like it was nothing, and she's like it was going out of style. And she got called to this place in Hazelden, Minnesota, and I said, all my problems are over. Because there she found the big book, and people talked to her about this, and my wife had gained, like Sharon was talking about, tons of alcohol-related weight, and she lost almost all of it at this place in Hazelden. She looked gorgeous. She was, and they had a transplanted Californian out there who was putting them through their paces. He was doing yoga. For God's sake, I hadn't done yoga in India, and I found myself doing yoga in Hazelden, Minnesota. And we were doing the meditations, and we were sharing. I mean, Detroit, you never use the word share. You talked. And here we were sharing. We were holding hands, for God's sake, and saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, this is wonderful. I said, this is great. She's going to be terrific out here. So I got out of Hazelden, Minnesota. And this is not, I'm not going to say anything about treatment centers. They have their place. And I'm sure it planted the seed, as my wife said, in her sobriety. But I was transferred to Chicago. And I was on cloud 15, you know, immediate contented sobriety. My wife is so... See, that was my problem. I had no personality of my own or feelings of my own. If Sue was angry, I was confused. Because I did not know the meaning of the word angry. My mother used to tell me as a child, don't lose your temper, because that's a part of you. I translated that to mean, don't get angry. And I just did not know how to handle this. There was a lot of rage, but I did not know how to handle it. If Sue was happy, I was elated. If Sue was angry, I was confused. If Sue was sad, I didn't know what the bloody hell to do. So when Sue came out, I was on cloud 15. I said, this is it. My problems are over. She is sober. Well, needless to say, in about 6 weeks after she was out, Sue went to drinking like it was... I heard an AA speaker say, he said, if the Pacific Ocean were alcohol, he was afraid that it was going to evaporate. And that's how my wife drank. And I plummeted about 16 stories emotionally and crashed. I don't know what the hell was going on. But something had changed in Chicago. I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting in Chicago, and Marsha and I were talking about this. She asked me when I got into Al-Anon. I said, oh, I got around Al-Anon in about 1980, but I really got into it late 81, early 82. I walked into this meeting in Chicago, and they handed me the big book of AA. And I read the book. And that book transformed or changed a lot of things for me in my thinking. For the first time, I recognized that my wife had a disease that transcended the physiological and physical and clinical definition of disease and entered the spiritual and mental and emotional realms of disease. For the first time, I felt compassion for this woman when all this time, all I had was disdain and contempt. I mean, I really did not like this woman. I wasn't sure if I loved her. The only reason I was there, and a lot of people say, oh, you know, you have a winning situation. You're still there with you're still married to the alcoholic in your life. I said, I did not stay there out of conscious thought, I mean, out of conscious desire. I stayed there because I was confused. I didn't know what the hell to do. There were times I knew that I would see her drunk on the floor, and I said, to hell with this, I'm going to go find me another woman. Where did I go? I'd go to a singles bar. I mean, great, same thinking. And then I'd get to the singles bar, and I would be so angry, I'd pull out the smelliest, stinkiest stogie I could find in my pocket and light it up so no woman in about a 30-yard circumference would even come close to me. Then I'd cuss all the women in the bar. I'd cuss my wife at home and still pray that she was passed out because I didn't want to talk to her, and I'd get back home. And that's same thinking. And I just didn't know how to do it. So here when they handed me the big book of AA, and I realized that this woman who drank, climbed a flight of stairs, fell down and cracked her ribs, and 6 weeks later went doing the same thing, was indeed sick, and I had no way of treating her. I was completely whipped. My name, Ajit, means one who cannot be beaten, and boy, I was a misnomer. I was completely whopped. This disease was more powerful, more devious, more demonic, more whatever you want to call it, and I had absolutely no way of dealing with it. But Al-Anon really helped me. You guys started teaching me the meaning of the word detachment. And I tell you this story about detachment. I was flying in from Minnesota, and my wife came to me. See, I wanted to get a divorce, but I didn't want to do it. I didn't know. You know, someone was sharing earlier, they said they'd rather be caught speeding and sent away to jail than have to confront, you know, get away from their wives consciously by making that decision saying, I'm leaving. So anyway, I decided that I wanted to leave my wife, but I did not know how. And my wife came up to me and she said, my psychologist tells me that you are causing me to drink, so I want a divorce. And the 4th of July occurred in my heart. I mean, there were flags going up, there were know, crackers, champagne was pouring out of every place. And I opened my mouth to say, hallelujah, let's go find an attorney. I opened my mouth and a voice that sounded like mine said, Sue, my program says not to make any rash decisions for 6 months to 12 months. I don't think we should do anything crazy like you leaving, we're getting divorced. We'll work this out. She said, okay, and went to the bedroom to get drunk on vodka. And I walked to the bathroom to kick myself because that wasn't my intention. See, that's the other thing the alcohol-producing companies, the trick they play on alcoholics. They tell them that vodka doesn't smell. Maybe not to the untrained nose, but to the potential Al-Anons, we can pick out the brand name. I mean, I could tell if it was Smirnoff's, if it was Popoff's, it was, you know, the type of label, I could tell what vodka she'd been drinking. But anyway, I continued to go to my meetings till one day I was flying in from Minnesota where my company was headquartered, the company I worked for, and Sue was supposed to pick me up at the airport. Well, I guess she decided she needed to level herself off, and she had a drink. And as they say, one drink is not is too many and 1,000 aren't enough. I think she had about 999 and slid off the road. And she did something crazy. When the cops got to her, she got into a fight with them. Now, Chicago cops don't like that too much. So they hit her on the head and took her off to jail. And she called me up the following morning and said, come bail me out. And I said, aha, I am detached. You cannot rot in there. See, that's not the meaning of the word detachment as I know it today. And that was distancing myself. Today I know detachment means releasing with love. Because that is for me. That love is toward me. Nothing to do with the person that I'm detaching. Because I'm taking that power away from them to control my emotions, my thoughts, my feelings. But I told her I am detached. And I walked into my meeting that evening with a swagger that John Wayne would have been proud of. And I stood in the doorway feeling 9 feet tall with my arms akimbo, and the guy looked at me and he said, what are you looking so proud about? And I said, I am detached. This program works. And they said, what are you saying? I said, my wife's in jail, and I refuse to bail her out. And they said, go bail her out. And I said, you confuse me. You tell me on the one hand, don't do it. On the other hand, you say, bail her out. I said, if you don't, they'll send her to Cook County Jail, and you do not send your worst enemy to Cook County Jail. Needless to say, I bailed her out, and as I was coming home, I made her feel this little. See, because that's where I was. I was this little inside. But the packaging, the image outside was all this bloated, self-righteous, indignant person. And Will Buckley would have been proud of the slant on my nose and the gaze of my eyes as I looked down upon her, telling her what a terrible person she was for embarrassing me by being in jail because I did not want to bail her out. But that was the beginning of the end, I think, because my detachment was creeping in without me realizing it. Because Sue asked me to find her an attorney, and I said, no, I care for you. This is what I told her, and I remember these words very clearly. I love you, but this is of your own doing. You need to find your own attorney. And she picked up the phone and found herself an attorney. I'd drop her off at the courthouse, and she'd stand there with her attorney pleading her case. And she allowed me to read a diary that she wrote sometime later. She realized that that was the beginning of the end, that there was a change coming on in me. This change was diminishing the hostility and the contempt I had in me. And there was a different kind of attitude. And Al-Anon is a program of changing attitudes. There was a different attitude that was prevailing in our relationship. I was there, but I wasn't there to pick up after her. She had to do her own dirty work. And I'm glad she saw that, because my program was starting to take hold here. I didn't know that. You know that knot that we have, that really gut-wrenching feeling that we have? I could almost feel the strands coming apart, and I was breathing a lot easier. The tension in my neck was dissipating. I was feeling a lot more comfortable about myself. The reason I said I felt this little is I did a few things that I wasn't very proud of. I used to go through a handbag. Now, I was raised as a child that a woman's handbag is so off limits to anyone, and I found myself going against my value system and going through a handbag, striking her every now and then. When she'd hit me, I'd spring back and hit her back. And I was raised in a family where violence was absolutely taboo, but violence against a woman was just unheard of. And to strike her made me feel so small. And here was a person who felt he was so terrific, because someone gave me a list of 18 defects of character. I couldn't find any in there that I could relate to. But deep inside the denial, they say, you know, there's an old saying, denial ain't a river in Egypt. And that's true, but this denial was deep in here. And I just sat there denying that I was this little. And so I reflected that from other people. Listen, this is how I felt towards other people. I made them feel small just so I could feel a little taller than them. But I started to work my program. The steps started to make a take on a different meaning for me. And I moved to California, and I remember this very clearly. It was in May, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in Irvine, California. It was a Friday night, and I found a bunch of small AA meetings. And I came in home, and I told my wife, said, you know, there are a bunch of AA meetings. If you want to try one, it's up to you. And she looked at me. She said, I think I'll go next week. And I had lost all expectations. You know, I did not have an expectation because I'd been hurt so many times by my expectations. But come Friday, a very groggy-looking woman walked with me to her first AA meeting. I remember to the moment my wife walked into AA, but I can't remember the time I walked into Al-Anon. See how preoccupied I was with her life. And my wife walked into her first AA meeting on the 25th of May, 1983, and has been sober and clean ever since. And, you know, thank you. She'll be delighted by that. And I know that Al-Anon got her to AA, not Ajit, because my hands-off policy, my detaching, despite my best efforts not to, but the program, you know, gets you, even if you're not working very hard at it, but if you show up three meetings a week, if you pretend to read the literature, something sneaks in every now and then and tells you the three C's. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, you can't cure it, or whatever they say. We had these pithy sayings that I hated too, but they started to sink in. You know, very cutesy, let go and let God. I hated that. You know, why let God when he's let you? You know, the self-control. My disease of willfulness, my way be done. But anyway, Sue walked into AA. I was in Al-Anon. We were a delightful couple. We attended all the AA Al-Anon functions. Or so much so our neighbors thought we were into a swinging club because I was hugging all the women, she was hugging all the guys. And we were gaining some notoriety in conservative Orange County. Till Sue came out and announced that she was an alcoholic to some close neighbors, and they were just shocked, but they accepted it. And it was fun. The meetings were fun. I started to understand the steps. Acceptance, the first one, admitting we were powerless over alcohol, suddenly that word alcohol changed into people, places, and things. And again, I was sharing with someone else, it's been 9, 10 years or what have you, but just in the last 1 or 2 years, the program is descending from here to here. It's a long travel from distance from the mind to the gut. And, you know, I could talk the language, but I didn't walk the walk, as they say. I mean, I could BS with the best of them. I could recite the steps backward, and I could have answered Jack's question this morning about the psychological nexus between the 12. Now, I know nothing about psychology, and I don't even know what the word nexus means, but I was qualified to tell you all about the 12 steps. And I could pontificate like crazy. And I read I found me a sponsor. God, I'm glad I found him. He said something to me that stuck with me. He says, if you want total freedom, you must take total responsibility for your feelings, for your emotions, for your thoughts. That's a heavy load. I mean, I couldn't point, as Sharon was talking about the three fingers, I couldn't point the one finger at anyone else and say, you made me do it. Today my son tells me, I tell him, you make me angry. He looks at me and says, I don't make you angry. I can't make you angry. And I said, this is a 5-year-old kid. Where'd you learn this from? Probably from me or my wife. But anyway, the first step started to make sense. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. My life was in shambles. I was not accomplishing what I wanted to accomplish in my career. I was focused on this other individual. This wife who had gone into AA, and our lives had achieved this immediate contented sobriety, was causing me more problems because I found I was obsessing on other areas of her life. Take the booze away. See, from alcoholics and drug addicts, first step, you take the booze away, they start in recovery. No slips. If you don't drink, you don't slip. We are like food addicts. You can't take us away from people. But you put me in front of a person, I'm going to obsess over this other individual. And I accepted that obsession. I said, this is the way I am. I'm not a bad person. I was born with this thing called obsessive compulsive behavior. That's the way it is, and I have to live with that and mitigate that issue, problem for myself, minimize it, or not allow it to hinder my progress in this program. The second step is a beautiful step to me. Am I running late or am I on target here? I know we started late. A couple more minutes because I'm so good? Okay, thank you. Anyway, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I heard a guy in our men's stag group. I go to a group of guys, 65 men in Al-Anon. That's marvelous. And none of them gay. I mean, I'm not saying that. Because, you know, some of you guys say, oh, it's for the, you know, sweet guys. It's not. It, I mean, even if you're gay, fantastic. Come on in. There are guys who are. But I'm just saying, it's just wonderful to see 65 guys talk about feelings. Man, I couldn't talk about that word. Leave alone expressing a feeling, I couldn't say the word feeling. It was so unmanly. But restored me to sanity. This guy said, that step is filled with hope because it means there was sanity someplace before and it's going to be restored back to me. And I love that. Turn my will and my thoughts over, turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I'd still have a hard time with that till I heard a woman from Oklahoma, a delightful lady by the name of Chink, say, turning my thoughts and my actions over to the care of God. And we have a wonderful prayer that we say in our men's stag group. It says, God, I want to be a partner with you in this business of living, accepting my full responsibilities and knowing that the rewards are freedom, growth, and happiness. And it goes on. I like that because I have to do the footwork. I can't just turn it over and walk away. And I, one of the other speakers, so a Californian expression, jazzed by the other speakers and the stuff they've said. You know, willingness without action is fantasy. What I think Sharon said that. It's just amazing. I mean, that is true because that's what I indulged in most of the time, just turning it over and walking away, thinking that he would do it for me. The fourth step has been fantastic for me. I took it with a bunch of AAs, the three-column thing, and I found all these resentments that I had that I never knew I had, these defects of character that I had that I never knew I had. But, you know, we, at least in Al-Anon, at least for myself, I came from this Mount Olympus feeling so good, and I was in the depths of hell in about 6 months, saying I was such a terrible person for the things I'd done to my wife. And I heard a man friend in my men's stag group say, he says, you know, our motives were right. It's just that our methods were wrong. All we wanted was sobriety and serenity for our spouses. Just the methods we employed just did not work, and we didn't know that. And was doing the 10-yard dash in a 9-yard room doesn't accomplish anything. But anyway. But as I worked through this fourth step, I was watching Star Trek. Let's see, you get your awakening. Someone gets them from Beacon Moving Trucks. I got them from Star Trek. I was watching Star Trek, and if you remember, if you're a Star Trek watcher, the old one, not the new one, as Captain Kirk is coming down this beam thing, and he splits into two. And one's an evil Kirk who's a terrific manager, and the other one's a good Kirk who cannot manage with a beam. To make a long story short, the good Kirk is sitting and talking to Spock. I guess he talks to Spock most of the time. And he said, how come the evil guy is such a terrific person, he's a terrific manager, where I can't even move my hand like Reagan, you know, just say what direction I'm supposed to go. And Spock, in his inevitable wisdom, said something that struck with me. He says, the forces that be give us the good with the bad, the bad to support the good. There are no defects of character. There is no evil. It's just good qualities turned around. And I saw a bumper sticker on a beat-up Pinto. It said, if it weren't for envy, there wouldn't be ambition. I like that. I said, if my God loves me, he could not have given me bad and good. That's my definition of it, and how I take something to its extreme. So whatever I have is something I need to work with just to grow in terms of my self-esteem. Someone talked about self-esteem this morning. And that was the progress that I had with the fourth step, the rooting out. And the fifth one, my God, talk about someone who indulged in image management. To sit across from someone and lay your dirt in front of them. Ah, it was painful. But I did it with a very loving human being who wasn't condemning or critiquing me. He simply took my fourth step and said, time to move on. Make your amends. Pray for defects of character to be removed. And I found what worked best for me was praying for one defect of character to be removed at a time. And the reason I heard someone say, he says, we move in the direction of our most dominant thoughts. So if that morning I think about one particular defect of character to be removed, even if I consciously forget about it, it's still working inside of me. And for some reason, it did the trick, and it kept working. Making amends was a trip. You know, the people who did the directed fourth step, after it written the names of people down to whom we needed to make amends, he said, how many of you have put your own name at the top of the list? There was not one soul in the room that had put their name at the top of the list. And I looked at the guy, I said, you know, you're right. The person I've abused the most is standing right here because I pretended to be something I'm not. I've acted insanely, pretending to be sane. I've done things to myself that I wouldn't do to my worst enemy. And my amends, I like the ninth escape clause, except to do unto others, except to do so would injure them or others. And it says, you know, changing your attitudes, changing your behavior towards these people. And I liked the change in attitude. The depth was coming into me. I started feeling better about myself, progressing into it. I also made an amends to a friend of mine. He and I had started a business, and it sort of fell apart. And he wanted me to put my share of the money into the failure. And I refused to do it because I said that he wasn't consulting me on the business. And something, you know, that voice inside of you nags you. You hate that nagging voice. It's not your wife's voice. It's something else. And I was laying down and said, if it had been successful, would you have argued about the fact that he did not consult with you often? And I said, no. I said, you owe him the money. And I wrote him a check. And I've sort of, that friendship has strained because I wrote a long, lengthy letter of amends, telling him why I was about to screw him out of the money and why I had changed my mind. And he said, all I wanted was a bloody check. He didn't have to write, you know, a litany on why. But it was for me. See, most of the things we do, despite the fact that we are out there to help someone else, giving of ourselves, ultimately, in my opinion, works for me. It makes me grow, makes me like myself better, makes me a better individual in terms of the giving and sharing of myself. I love the 11th step. And I, you know, people throw these words at you that stick in. How many times we heard the 11th step said on and on and on, till one day I heard someone say, it says, it's a footwork step. It says, sought. And he emphasized the word sought through prayer and meditation to improve, which means it's already there. We're just improving upon our conscious contact with God as we, you know, to pray for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. To pray for the knowledge of my will is mostly what I wanted to do. But the program teaches me that I have to have trust and faith in his will for me because that is best for me. Because I focus on this little dot in this mosaic and I see it as that, as an isolated incident. And as I step away from it in terms of time, the pattern starts to fall into place and I say, I know why now I did not succeed at that. I'm glad I did not because look how it's worked out. And my relationship, my God, thanks to Al-Anon, has changed. I came from a background where my relationship with God was based on superstition and fear. If I did this egocentric view, you know, that this God has nothing to do with the 6 billion creatures on this earth alone, but he's got this telescope pointed at this one person, Ajit, and says, you're terrific, here's a reward. You're awful, boom, you know, I'm going to hit you with a scud. Fortunately, it missed a few times. But anyway, that relationship has improved. That journey in trying to seek this God outside of me has now changed inward, and I'm looking, that God is within me. I feel that. I heard a man say, he says, we are perfect. There are imperfections about us. And I read a book where the guy says, we are not human beings doing spiritual things. We are spiritual beings having human experience. I like that. Now, it may not coincide with a lot of religious theories and what have you. It works for me because that gives me my connection with God. The spiritual awakening is this process, taking the act on the road or whatever you do, filling up the coffee mugs or cleaning out the ashtrays in the meeting, despite some meetings are still smoking meetings, most meetings are turning non-smoking, but doing the service part. And I used to have this ego trip about being a speaker, you know, wow, they've asked me to speak. And then I'd come in and act with false humility and I'd say, I don't know, what the hell do you get out of this? You know, why do they ask you to speak? And till one day I was walking out of a meeting and a woman came up to me. You know, God works in mysterious ways and does work through other people. She looked at me and she said, you know, I have a tape. This must be from my arrogant days when I first started speaking. And she had a tape of mine and she said, I listened to your tape and that's what sustained me and brought me back to Al-Anon. And the only way I can decipher that is she said, if this crazy guy can get it, or at least speaks like he has it, then maybe there is hope. And that's all I could get from that. But I'm glad. So now I take this task about coming and speaking at meetings, I take it very seriously because it's a privilege. And if I have the ability to stand in front of a crowd and say something that someone might get something out of, I'm really grateful for that. Because that, I pray, I say, God, you speak through me. So if you don't like what I've said today, blame him, don't blame me, or her, or it, or whatever. I just want to finish up by telling you that I love alcoholics. I love my wife. We have several kids, all born in sobriety. My wife is practicing her program to the best of her ability. But I also want to finish up and tell you why God loves alcoholics. Now, some of you may have heard the story, but the story is about a bunch of this very eminent priest who's been dead for about 5 years, and he's been waiting rather patiently outside the gates of St. Peter, I mean, Pearly Gates, waiting for St. Peter to let him in. And behind him is an eminent line of eminent gurus and imams and rabbis, all waiting patiently. They've been waiting. And all of a sudden, this rather ravishing-looking young woman, about 25 years of age, in a very tight leather skirt, sorry, guys, I didn't mean to cause you to fantasize here, looking rather drunk, shows up. And St. Peter, as fast as his sandaled feet and his roped body could carry him, comes rushing to the gates, opens them up, and lets this woman in. And this priest is incensed. He says, God, he says, I've been waiting here for 5 patient years, and I've preached many a sermon, I've given my life to the service of God, and I've saved many a soul. I've listened to some lousy confessions, you know, with a smile on my face like an Al-Anon. But here this woman comes in drunk. You don't even give her any time. You snap her in. St. Peter says, my child, you don't understand. He said, this woman has been drinking and driving since she was 16. And in those 9 years, she's put the fear of God in more people than you've done in a lifetime. I want to thank you again for asking me to speak.